Hello and welcome to Encounter. David Rutledge with you, and because it's the first Encounter of the month, I'm welcoming you also to Encounter's Ethos series, where we look at the ethical issues behind what's going on in the world today. If you're thinking of taking up a worthy cause, then this week's program might inspire you to think just that little bit longer and harder about what you could be getting into. Maybe you've been moved to throw your lot in with an Indigenous people seeking independence, or a fledgling nation struggling to develop its economy. You've prepared your activist toolkit, and you're ready to shoulder the burden of a noble struggle. But today, producer Margaret Coffey suggests that you pause a moment first and consider some potential ethical pitfalls that lie in wait for the unwary.
Now that East Timor has achieved independence, the experience of West Papuans has begun to attract attention. West Papua has been under Indonesian control for 40 years, since its Dutch colonial government was forced out and a UN brokered agreement came into force. In those 40 years, tens of thousands of West Papuans have died, and an organised independence movement has evolved out of the struggle for self-determination. For a year now, the West Papuan independence movement's flag, the Morning Star, has flown on a prominent Melbourne corner. The flag was raised at the conclusion of a ceremony in a nearby Anglican church. Sun Up One Time, it was called. Stand Up Together for West Papua. This story of Sun Up One Time begins with a person, perceptions, and a pig.
One image that comes out of West Papua consistently with the media is the one of the Highland men in their penis gourds, or otherwise the OPM with threadbare cloth and handmade wooden guns. And that is part of their identity, I mean, but it shortchanges their political aspirations because Westerners look at those penis gourds and think they're a bunch of tribals going nowhere.
The person being Louise Byrne, who's committed to the West Papuan cause.
And so I figured somehow we have to cut across that image because there's much more to West Papua than just those two sets of images that seem to predominate. So I searched for something that would be meaningful for the Papuans and also that we could understand. Now, I don't think pigs are a major part of our life, but at least they're kind of cute, and after Babe, there's a sort of something about pigs.
I'm Margaret Coffey with an encounter about activism and the difficulties of making symbolic meanings. And this is how the pig comes into the story.
Pigs are central to the village economies in PNG and the Solomons, parts of Fiji, West Papua, of course. You know, so it's really what they call the biggest country of Melanesia, the island of New Guinea, and especially in the highlands where the pig is so central. It's like a form of negotiation. So before you go to war, you'll sit down with your tribe and have a big pig feast, drumming yourself up for war. When one enemy sees a pig coming from the other side, they know that there's negotiated settlement on the way. So we bought a little pig. I mean, we bought him from this shearer guy up in Dalesford who had this whole shed full of pigs he was breeding to sell for Coles Christmas hampers, you know. So he sold us the pig. It cost about $50. And then we brought it down to Melbourne, and he grew up on the front steps of our St Kilda flat. But he had needs, like eating every day, and I had needs, like going to the meetings and things. At All Saints Anglican Church in East St Kilda, there's a caretaker there who's a wonderful man, also the secretary of the church, and he's got a big backyard. So he agreed to take the pig every day to feed there.
I'd never met her.
Mark Stevens is the caretaker.
I just had a knock on the door, and a friend of mine had this lady in tow who happened to be Louise Byrne. She said, Louise has got a pig and it needs somewhere to graze, and you've got a very big backyard. Would you like to have a pig for a while? And I thought, I've never come across a pig being a city boy. And I said, oh, okay, I'll have it for a few weeks to see what happens. And then he came over. But it was just a ring at the front doorbell that started the whole thing off.
Yabon used to go over there. And because I'd talked a lot to Mark about West Papua and why the pig was part of our lives and all this, he understood the political situation as well. And Mark's the sort of guy where everyone goes there for coffee, the choir, visiting priest, the resident priest. So this awareness of West Papua grew through Yabon being there and also being so closely next door to us, you know, Jacob living in St Kilda as well. That was the genesis of this event.
It's a symbol of justice.
Jacob, being Jacob Rumbiak, a leader of the West Papuan independence movement, a veteran of Indonesian jails and now a refugee in Australia.
People of West Papua, they're suffering. Please help them, bring them out from, you know, suffering to peace.
The West Papuan thing started a little bit later, when Louise started to talk to me and show me things, pamphlets and that, and I met Jacob.
Bring them from unlove to love.
In all of my experiences with West Papuan leaders, and my experience is not extensive, but it's deep, there was always an extraordinary religious component in what they were talking about.
Jacob Rumbiak is one of those leaders. And you'll remember Catholic Bishop Hilton Deacon's long association with the East Timorese community in Australia. Here he speaks of West Papuans.
It wasn't the Catholic tradition that they were espousing, but they had this deep and riveted belief that in all of the struggle that they were enduring and having to put their minds and hearts to, and maybe their blood and their very lives, had something to do with God. God for them was the transcendent and other that they found in the Bible.
And still there are the pigs. In the early days, the Indonesian army evidently made a point of slaughtering West Papua's pigs by the thousands.
The pig got fatter very quickly. It made a total mess of my backyard. It was like a rotary hoe. He discovered a path under the grass that had been buried for many years that no one knew about. He used to respond to his name. You could sit on his back, you could cuddle him. He loved being scratched on the belly, he'd roll over. Things I didn't know about pigs, I found out about.
The pig is so central. It's like a form of negotiation.
And a symbol that might be made meaningful for us.
Yes, Louise is a fairly, could I say, pushy lady. When she first mentioned the idea of the service, I thought, well, there's no way known that this will happen in this church, but it has, it did.
The idea was to build a ceremony, a service in a church, that would bring together West Papuan tradition and Christian ritual and Melanesian identity in the cause of land, liberty and solidarity for West Papuans. The idea was to enact the way West Papuans invest political purpose with religious meaning.
They were in fact not prepared to go on if people were going to be irreligious in their attitude towards these people and what they believed in, or if they belittled what they were saying. In fact, I think it was that aspect of it, the fear that people in Australia who are trying to develop a movement of support for the West Papuan cause would be dumped if they carried on being the secular, non-believing people that a lot of them really are. That's not a criticism, that's a description of what I think is the fact of the matter.
This is Encounter on Radio National, where we're approaching the nub of a broader problem. At RMIT's Globalism Institute, they began to talk about it.
Particularly in the Asia-Pacific area, around West Papua, around East Timor, people have related their politics and their religion together. And when they come to a place like Australia, what they find is they're met by the scepticism of activists who are concerned about a particular national liberation movement or a particular way in which they can stop oppression in those places. And our attempt was to actually start to talk through that, to get away from the disdain of some of the activists for the religious as an important component of the way of life of the people they're trying to support, and to at the same time recognise that there are complications in any relationship between the sacred and the political, and those complications have to be addressed very carefully, otherwise you can set up situations which are damaging to both.
That's Paul James, director of the Globalism Institute. The message? Be careful of messing about with the sacred, but don't ignore it, even at the cost of discomfiture.
It occurred particularly around East Timor and West Papua, where we had people saying, oh, that icky religious stuff, we'd want to keep away from that. We just want to support the people, as if the people themselves weren't Christians in their own political activism. It's a very powerful response, partly because the history is so vexatious. The person who is an activist and is supporting a new setting where they think life is going to be better want to argue for leaving the past behind, and often that ickiness that I'm describing is not just about the religiosity of Christianity, but it's also around any forms of mysticism at all, any forms of tribal or traditional sense of faith, any forms of animism, questions of association with the spiritual. And what we see from the political side is a distress about how, firstly, the missionaries came into those places and changed the nature of the place. And having changed the nature of the place, they feel as if it's no longer something they can support in a wholehearted way. They're concerned, in a way, about supporting a new modern nation state arising out of the primordial mud of the old. And that mud makes people feel very uncomfortable, whether it's of the tribal traditional kind or of the even the modern Episcopal kind.
On the other hand, says Bishop Deacon, West Papuans, East Timorese,
they want to be respected. They themselves have thought about this sort of Christianity or these sorts of Christianities, and they are part of the equipment, the intellectual and emotional equipment that they bring to the solution at hand. I found in East Timor, and I was drawing on my experience in East Timor, that East Timorese people generally were very sensitive religiously. It wasn't religiosity, it was much deeper than that. And I used to be absolutely made breathless by the responses of 17, 18, 19-year-old young people and their attitude towards the possibility of being raped by the soldiers of the invading army, or having their brother taken away and dropped from a helicopter, or a young man telling me that that's exactly what might happen to him. And the way in which they saw this wasn't fatalistic. It was sort of part of the plan of things, and they got strength from this inner belief that they had about the whole business. So that when people came, as they eventually did, into East Timor through the overseas agencies of one sort or another, and there was very little religious component in anything that they tried to offer to the people, a big mistake was being made. And I fear that something similar was happening here in West Papua.
And if it were ignored, if those religious meanings were left aside?
The outcome would be that the will of the West Papuan people is not being respected. People from other ways, other political ways and other religious or non-religious ways are then looking for solutions to the problems at hand, and the only ones that they will accept or the ones that they will put their mind and their hearts to will be ones that don't have this religious component in them. I mean, the Australians, NGOs even, can make this mistake.
Bishop Hilton Deacon.
Might I also offer abiding thanks to...
And that's how SUNUP One Time, standing together with West Papua, came to be constructed as a gesture of respect. From the beginning, there were risks.
It got off to a fairly rocky start, and a few things were nutted out about what would be allowed and would not be allowed, and... It took a lot of negotiation and compromise on both sides, I think.
The first dynamic to be overcome was the relationship between the Melanesians and the bishop. They'd never come across a man like Hilton Deacon before in terms of their religious leaders. at home, even at a dinner, the bishop or even the priest will sit apart. He'll be served a special plate of food. He wouldn't just, you know, go and help himself. He's often carried, sort of looking like a Roman emperor. You'd never relate to a religious leader in the way that we can relate to them here. So they could see that they were going to be developing a longer-term relationship with this man and felt that a meeting, even for an event here, would have longer-term ramifications for their lives. He's quite good at disarming people.
Yes, it was an attempt to, first of all, sensitise us to become familiar with the way in which West Papuan people express themselves when it comes to these terribly vital issues about freedom and independence and wanting peace and so on. Also, it was an effort to help the West Papuans own what was being done. This wasn't being done for them. It was them and us doing something together that was totally on their terms. And so we used a lot of the signs and symbols that are so familiar to them and are quite unfamiliar to us, like the pig's head, for instance, in a church. Some people would have found that revolting. There you are.
It was a little pig, the son of Yabon, tethered at first in the bushes while people gathered around. They built a fire that would singe the hair away and got ready the morning star flag of the West Papuan independence movement. Here the people were Melanesian, from PNG, Vanuatu, West Papua, and they knew what they were doing. Perhaps the pig did too.
Well, ritually killed, the blood draped on the West Papuan flag. And that was the flag that was raised later on at the end of the service. And there's a big crowd on the corner, Dandong Road, Chapel Street.
Solidarity is the theme of the speech. Solidarity for West Papuans among Melanesians.
Natani te mauri mangani West Papua. Nanga tangona aning eta. Tan Melanesia watu pun lotae. Nanga nakani West Papua e ubin hata to. Ni Melanesia. Iyo. Yo. Antwar.
Pig was stunned first. It lay on the West Papuan flag, and its blood ran on the morning star. In the end, there was pig meat for a mumu and a pig's head for the procession next day to the altar of All Saints. On Radio National's Encounter, we're talking about risks to the sacred. I'm Margaret Coffey, and we're about to enter church for a ceremony of solidarity with the West Papuan struggle for independence.
Well, that event could have been a prayer service, and probably the pig would not have played any role. In New Guinea, they will bring live pigs to a church to give to the priest instead of money, but I doubt whether it would be slaughtered in that ritual sense, and I I am quite sure it would not have been taken in and placed on the altar. So that was one thing. In the highlands of New Guinea, the Catholics, for instance, when you have communion, your first communion, you'll dress up in all your tribal feathers and all that sort of stuff. So some of that procession would not be new to the Pacific people. I think essentially the boundary that was broken was the role of the pig and how he was considered as central to that ceremony. That was probably the big difference between what would happen here and what could happen there.
Dear friends, may I welcome you to All Saints East and Kilda this afternoon as we come together in prayer, fellowship and solidarity with our brothers and sisters of West Papua.
They've been told how to behave religiously for a long time. And to get beyond that, to get to a deeper level where their culture was coming out as opposed to their religious education, was quite a hard process. And I knew the sort of boundaries we could push in this society. So I was sort of willing to kind of push things in a way that if I hadn't known the Melanesians quite as well as I did, or Bishop Deacon or the Anglicans, I would have been a bit holding back as well. So I was quite happy to push, and Bishop Deacon was quite happy to push, and as it turned out, so were the Anglicans. But that was what you might call a risk, because we weren't quite sure of them. We hadn't worked with them before.
The word of God was spoken, and our land was formed. The word of God who called forth our tribes.
Someday, undoubtedly, someone will go home to West Papua, to PNG, to Vanuatu, and say, look, this is what we did in Australia.
And brought us into being. Let this word guide our steps with wisdom, love and peace for the cause for West Papua.
There are some very dreadful ways in which it could have happened, and if there are inklings of that in any either attempts to replicate it or in the minds of people who were there, it becomes a kind of postmodern view about how the sacred works, that simply if it feels right to you, then it's okay. And if it felt right that this ritual occurred in church grounds, then that's fine too. But that kind of postmodern movement the church takes at its own peril is intrinsically undermining of what is the traditional way of understanding the sacred, because the postmodern understands it's an aesthetic, the traditional understands it as a verity, a truth. And unless there's a careful negotiation of those relationships, it could turn into a postmodern carnival circus of the worst possible kind. So I think there are great dangers, but my understanding is that there was a careful attention paid to those dangers and that it didn't become like that.
We were discussing what we were actually doing. None of us were quite sure, actually, you know, and to try and galvanise our thinking or distill it or some word like that, I said at the meeting, are we talking about the pig of God? And like everyone just went, no, 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 no. And so that was too far, that we weren't doing that. What we were doing was fully expressing the Papuan culture, okay, and the Christian culture here was welcoming of allowing that space in their own Christian tradition. I mean, the pig's got no place in Judeo-Christian tradition.
Not a place of honour or usefulness. The book of Leviticus advises Jews that the pig, even though it has divided hooves and is cleft-footed, it does not chew the cud, and therefore it is unclean. Muslims, including Indonesia's Muslim soldiers and transmigrants in West Papua, inherited the idea that the pig is unclean. Christians don't have a specific view about pigs.
So that's why it was really big. There was a meeting of equals. There was no sense in that ceremony that the Papuans were there kind of adorning the place with their feathers and their music. It felt much deeper. So that's where it was a very special day.
The cross is the greatest symbol of humility and love, God's love for us. It is the greatest symbol of freedom and peace.
I thought it was an incredibly complicated thing to pull off without it becoming a relativizing of the church, open to all sacred expressions. But it seemed to me that was talked through very carefully, and that they were two traditions of the sacred which were coming into connection with each other in the same place, rather than a synthesizing of the two. Because there are real problems around the question of sacrifice, because the question of sacrifice is an entirely different conception within the two religious traditions. If the sacrifice of the pig was seen as homologous with, say, the sacrifice within the New Testament style of ideas of how God gave of his son, then you're actually confusing those things incredibly and taking away from both of them.
That was the big thing, you know, to be able to take the pig's head that we'd sacrificed the day before up this beautiful, amazingly deep red vermilion carpet, you know, and all these steps and walk through this gold gate, which it looks like something out of a Bible illustration, and up onto the altar. And the deep sense of reverence that the West Papuans and the Melanesians all put into that procession, because their Christian faith is so deep, as well as their traditional faith. So they knew what they were doing.
In West Papua and the other Melanesian societies, a person without land is like a driftwood, one who has no roots and no direction. Land gives a sense of identity and a sense of belonging. It is from the land that the Melanesian people find sustenance and life. The head of the pig, now presented in this procession, represents the land that God made and gave to each of our tribes in the human race, setting the boundaries of our habitation. The pig also has great significance in our Melanesian.
The pig's head lay on the altar, where at other times the unbloody sacrifice of the Eucharist takes place. During the Eucharist, before the bread and wine are brought to the altar, while it is incensed, even the book is removed. How do you preserve meaning while you're making meaning?
If you can call him a he, it was just a pig's head in a tray. It was offered to God and placed on the altar. That was a very difficult thing for the church to accept here, but it was allowed because of the significance to the West Papuan people. You offer the best to God, and it was taken as a sacrifice. You could regard it as money, but it was actually just a pig's head. Anyway, it happened, and that's it.
The pig's head was the first gift laid on the altar. Jacob Brumbach carried it.
Father God sacrificed Lord Jesus to all people on the world, including to Papuan, is one time only, no more time. So we come there in church for say thank Lord about what you give to Papuan, including independence, will Papuan accept in short time future.
Then there were broken chains, calling up liberty, and finally flags from Australia and the Pacific to speak of solidarity.
Everybody that I've talked to about it were pleased and proud that it happened and didn't feel that it was a bad thing or complicated in ways that had caused danger or damage to either of those traditions. But that doesn't mean that there are people who were quietly sitting in the congregation who weren't confronted in the most appalling way by it, and I haven't spoken to them, no. I'm sure there were people who were puzzled. Yeah, I'm sure that's the case.
The Jews of the temple saw that they had nothing to give to God. All they could do was give something back. So they sacrificed certain animals and birds. That's different again from giving your best to God in the hope that God will give to you. Each of these notions of sacrifice represents a distinctive religious idea that has given internal form to distinctive histories. How do you make meaning while you're preserving meaning.
There's an immense responsibility, and no person can take it on themselves. That responsibility is a question of negotiation. Discomfort is something which is built into that process in negotiation, so that because it feels uncomfortable doesn't make it necessarily wrong.
Why do we do it? Why have we bothered to come here and to put together a ceremony of extraordinary complexity?
Some people didn't come because it was in that Anglican church. That Anglican church is high. Some Catholic nuns said, "Why, Louise, are you working with them?" Some Anglican priests said, "Why are you working with them? They're not representative because they're high Anglican, you know." But you must create things that are complex so that you're not monodimensional. West Papua's struggle isn't monodimensional, so our representations of it in solidarity shouldn't be monodimensional either.
The reason why the Anglican Church was chosen was because Anglicans do have a high profile in West Papua in mission terms. And there was, in fact, one Anglican priest there who is a very active and articulate supporter of the West Papuan cause. And he's been trying to shift the solidarity of the Anglican clergy and lay people in Melbourne to get behind the West Papuan thing with some little bit of success. It was an important move because all of us wanted to have an ecumenical dimension to this on our side. So this was a benefit for us that in the long run would be beneficial to the West Papuans. But the Catholics will romp all over the place in support of independence movements and human rights and so on. And others will vary according to how much you shout about it or whatever their capacities are or whatever even their intellectual traditions are. All of these things circumvent what they decide they want to do. And so to have this done in an Anglican church was, for me, an important move for the West Papuan people.
Very few parishioners, if any, came. I can't give a reason for that.
A lot of the people who were there were not Anglicans at all. They were anything, they were everything. There were a few Catholic nuns there and other people like that, for instance. But there were a lot of people who have no affiliation with any religion at all, not even vestigial. But they felt comfortable because their friends were there, and their friends being the West Papuans and those supporters of the West Papuans. What did it do to them? I think for them it was a steep learning curve, for one thing. I mean, they go into these places and they're almost as strange and unfamiliar to them as would be a ceremony somewhere in the highlands of West Papua. They don't know what all the configurations are on the walls and what the stained glass windows mean anymore. All of that's gone. It's hard to tell the effect that it would have on any of them. But again, I spoke to a lot of them later, and they used words like they were moved by the symbolism. And they talked about its power being, I suppose, its impressive capacity.
But it wouldn't have worked if they didn't understand.
By the time you're at that stage where you have a church full of people and they do not understand any of the symbols, the religion has lost the plot. It is of the essence of a valid, if you like, or an effective rite, a religious rite, that there be some sort of understanding, a shared understanding of the elements of the ritual.
Well, as I said before, a lot didn't come because it was in the church. Left wing, but I would say categorically, the left wing, the paralysed left wing in Melbourne didn't come either.
choir were the most involved group in the church, as well as some school children from local school. They had to learn pidgin. The biggest impact was on the choir and their parents. A lot of people came that don't belong to the parish that came out of interest. The service was quite a spectacle. Everyone in their native costumes and that. The sounding of the conch and things like that were very moving.
The ceremony didn't stop at the church. Standing together with West Papua, in fact, meant to stroll to the corner, and there the bloodied flag was raised.
The flag raising was very moving. What was particularly noticeable to me was at the end of the service, when everyone came to my backyard or Yabon's backyard, the solidarity that was very evident amongst the Melanesian people. So groups from Fiji, Vanuatu, PNG, all over the place, and they all were going to be united for this one cause. And you could see it, you could feel it, it was all brothers and sisters. It was quite striking.
When we started talking about the sacrifice of the pig in order that we could raise the flag and name Morning Star Corner on the corner of Dandenong and Chapel Street Road, we really started to link into symbolism, deep symbolism, because everyone knows Dandenong Road goes right around Australia, and at Cape York it's sort of 20 miles from Papua. And there was something deep about the sense of sacrifice and the naming of Chapel Street and Morning Star Corner.
G'day, how are you? Do you want to hold this? Let it go through your hand. There you are.
And we jazzed it up a bit, you know, Bishop Deacon going up a ladder. But there was all this sort of fun, serious stuff, symbolism, extraordinary art involved. An extraordinary sense of not religions merging, but relating to each other and accepting of each other and respecting each other. That was the big thing, you know.
Well, I think a lot of people didn't even know that we had a flagpole until the flag went up. People didn't know what flag it was. They just say, oh, it's a flag of a foreign country, and I say, well, it's not a foreign country because it doesn't exist as a country, it's a part of Indonesia. I didn't think it would actually stay up there as long as it has. I thought it would have been taken down by someone, but it hasn't.
Almost every tribe in West Papua, everybody got a message from the Morning Star.
The Morning Star flag still flies proudly on the corner of Highway No. 1 Dandenong Road. For those who know, and for everyone who stood up for West Papua in the church around the corner, the white star against the red background above blue and white stripes is invested with political and religious meaning, and it was raised on the strength of political and religious imagination.
I just always go back to self-determination, and it's pretty undefined because it's too hard to define in many ways. You know, and I sort of got back to Ben-Hur. He was saying, let my people go. And then I thought, well, then you go through all the history, the Bolsheviks, everyone's saying the same thing. Let my people go, and or let me go. I think that's the same thing. I feel constrained as well, or I feel oppressed as well. So it's about expression, you know, the right to express. And I think what I do is facilitate that.
What we're at is having people like us, Anglo-Saxon white Australians, understand that there is a dynamic about the West Papuan world that we must be aware of, we must recognise that exists if we're going to talk about freedom for them and liberation for them, that it isn't just a political question, it isn't just a socio-economic question, it has a great deal more to it than that.
The ceremony standing up for West Papua was no ordinary form of activism. It invoked religious beliefs not only to understand different histories, but also to change them. Something happened there that needed talking about, and they began a discussion at RMIT's Globalism Institute.
We structured it by first having a panel, and the panel was to speak from their various positions, and we wanted people who were both secular and sacred, people who worked within the church, and their major job was to be part of the church, and yet were in their outreach political. And we chose people who were either research or engaged politically, people who were open to talking about religious questions and the sacred.
You could hear in the discussion the difficulty for everyone, for people detached from religious histories, for people who never had any, or for people who don't want to begin one, and especially for people who could not trust in being understood.
The sacred came down to that which cannot be described, which gives awe and a sense of complexity to the world which humans find themselves in as a part rather than as the dominant species on a planet which can be called a resource. And so that sense of awe of the thing which cannot be named became the only way in which people could actually describe the sacred. It was absolutely intended that people would talk in a full-blooded, embodied and difficult way about what it meant for them to be religious or to be spiritual. And a distinction was attempted to be drawn between the institution of the church and being spiritual, which was an important distinction, which was easy to make from an academic distance, but was one hard for the people inside it. But when we got to the forum itself, what we found is that people became overawed not by the spiritual, but by the situation of talking politically about the spiritual. A lot of people from Pacific Islands, from Fiji, from the Solomons, from West Papua, from East Timor were invited, and they found it harder to tell those stories than anybody else.
So the conversation must continue. The experience of East Timor has made that clear.
It's a very delicate process of being politically active. Taking seriously the people you're involved with is a key concern without romanticising them. Now, as persons within Australia who are a political activist, it becomes crucial to deal with those people in their full complexity. What happens is you get excited about the liberation process, and then after liberation you feel as if you've been entirely left down by the new steps, which are to step back into institutional church and the institutional state. One of the things which happens is that persons who were once romantic leaders, religious leaders or political leaders in a liberation movement, then become part of an institutional church, and they have to go through the same requirements of institutional churches as any other person. And the romance drops away really quickly, and you find people who have been supporting the movement then at the very time when the movement needs support in its full complexity feel disgruntled or feel the stage is now finished.
Which is why our story began, in an imaginative attempt to make activism at home with complexity, in a risky encounter with the sacred.
The starting point for me, and it's not me as a Catholic bishop, it's me, Hilton Deacon, human being, and an Australian to boot, citizen. The fact that I'm a Catholic bishop, for the purposes of the reaction to this problem, is in some sense incidental, but I'm not foolish enough to think that being a Catholic bishop is of no consequence in this debate. Of course it is. But as a human being, I want to treat the West Papuans as fellow human beings and give them all of the sensitive respect that I've been trained to give to people in whatever position they find themselves in, not least if they're in a position of being oppressed and they're crying out for independence and freedom from the suffering that's being imposed upon them, even at this moment while we talk, I might add. Now, one can call that a sublimated cultural imperialism. I hope not. It's certainly not my thought on the matter. But I will say that I'm highly sensitive to the possibility that one could slip into this, and that's one thing I'm more sensitive about than most, actually, in this sort of an issue.
When I'm trying to design a ceremony or facilitate or bring about, I've always got this notion of ritual, which I've come about through my own relationship with music and literature, where you, that sense of the sublime, where you can feel your internal psycho-emotional space being altered by an event. It doesn't often happen. That's where you aim for. Now, you can't ever guarantee that that's going to come about. As a facilitator, I can't even guarantee to get 10 people into the church. It's just this extraordinary confluence of energies and the stuff in the newspapers that's floating about, and occasionally you pull it off and it happens and people are altered. I don't read it anyway cynically. I think some people might, but I don't read participation at those sort of events as self-defeating or opportunist. I mean, people call me an opportunist in the way I work with the church, but, you know, who cares? I think creating fulfilling moments in people's lives, you know, it's not, I don't know, it's not a bad thing, really, is it? Well, it's a way of filling up another day.
Thank you to Louise Byrne, Mark Stevens, Bishop Hilton Deacon and Paul James. Paul James is director of the Globalism Institute at RMIT in Melbourne, hosted the forum Kindling the Sacred. Rachel Kerr and Louise Byrne interviewed Jacob Rombayak. Technical production of this encounter, Risking the Sacred, was by Carrie Dell. I'm Margaret Coffey.